In this episode, I'm joined by Steve Nepper, who is Associate Professor in the Department of English Rhetoric and Humanistic Studies at the Virginia Military Institute. In this episode, we discuss his book, Wonder Strikes, Approaching Aesthetics and Literature with William Desmond, alongside discussions on being, God, prayer, silence, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast or gain access to some exclusive content or just keep everything running, then please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Steve Nepper, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show. It's an honor to be here.
Thanks very much. We're going to be discussing your recently published book, Wonder Strikes, Approaching Aesthetics and Literature with William Desmond, which is a book, as people will imagine, tackling the thought of William Desmond whilst drawing in literature and art and figures such as Dante, it's a really encyclopedic text. I mean, it's jumping all over the place, and I don't mean that in a bad way. From one moment to the next, you're jumping between literary ideas and imbuing these with Desmond's own philosophy. And we're going to talk about these things such as the excess of being, porosity, and these, where Desmond's work intersects with a lot of these things. So, I'm looking forward to the conversation. But before we begin, just tell us a little bit about yourself and, how was this book came to be at all?
Sure. In some ways, it's strange that I ended up writing a book like this. My graduate studies were in American literature, and I'm very interested in that. I talk about a lot of American writers in the book. But even during my PhD studies, I became increasingly interested in the relationship between religion, philosophy, and literature and art. And I was especially sort of as grown out of some struggles of my own struggles. I've always kind of struggled to be present, to be in the moment, to be attentive, to be aware. And I was sort of looking around for spiritual and artistic practices that would help with that. I wanted to live a fuller life, to have a fuller life, to be more in the moment, but I also wanted to better attend to those around me. And when I had my first child, that definitely made that even more important to me. So about 7 or 8 years ago, I read this essay called The Ways of Wondering by the contemporary Irish philosopher William Desmond. And I had heard of Desmond before. I knew that he was a really prominent contemporary Catholic thinker. I knew that he had a really original metaphysics in a time that metaphysics was a bad word in philosophy. But I also knew that he didn't just sort of brush aside the criticisms of metaphysics. Some of them he saw as overblown or totalizing, and he did push back against those. But he also took on board a lot of the concerns about overreach, about sort of a false sense of systematic closure, about pinning things down too much in a system. So he has this really supple, I knew he had this really supple philosophy kind of between metaphysics and phenomenology, kind of a personalism sort of mixed in there too. So I'd always sort of knew he was someone I wanted to read, but I hadn't sort of got past that kind of Wikipedia page knowledge of him until I read this essay. And this essay just blew me away, especially his descriptions of these experiences of astonished wonder that kind of break us open again, that draw us out of ourselves, that bring us into the moment and reawaken us to the excess of reality. And these could be things like, a moving sunset or a really powerful thunderstorm or the face of your newborn child, or it could be something like a near-death experience where on the other side of it, you have that close call and you're like, whoa, all the colors are brighter and life is more vivid and I'm really grateful to be here. And so that account of wonder and also his account of why in modernity, we seem to be sort of more closed off to that. And we don't sort of know how to sort of process those experiences. They're really important in people's lives. I bet they're important in yours, they're important in mine. But we don't really have like a way of sort of incorporating those richly into experience, incorporating those into how we think about the world, especially not publicly. So I was really moved by this essay. And so I just started reading everything from Desmond that I could find. And before I knew it, I was working on this book and learning a ton while doing it, not just learning a lot intellectually, but getting some of those answers I was hoping for about practices for being more present, being more attentive, really thinking through aesthetic experience and religious experience. You've had Father Ryan Duns on the show before, and he's written a really excellent book about Desmond and Charles Taylor called Spiritual Exercises for a Secular Age. And one of the things he says in that book that I nodded to was he says to read Desmond in the right spirit is to undergo this spiritual practice. It kind of transforms you. And that was true to my experience. And I'm hoping that my book could help share that kind of experience with others.
Do you feel, you know, since you've been on this sort of Desmond journey that you've been successful in becoming more attentive?
Oh, yeah, but it's always an up and down, right? You could just ask my my wife or my children that, you know, I'll have periods where I feel like I'm in the moment where I'm attentive, where I'm responsive, and I'll have times where I'm sucked into my screens and, you know, doom scrolling and, you know, or lost in thought or worry.
Yeah, I mean, I suffer from that as well, but I think I've come to the realization that just severing the tie quite absolutely, as in getting rid of the screen, is just is never the answer, right? I just go find another equivalent of a screen to go look at, or just, you know, stare at the wall or something until bedtime, something like that, right? The screen isn't the problem. I guess it's the, you know, it's the means isn't the problem, it's the intents, right? Before we venture deeper into the work of Desmond, I of course have to ask you the question which I'm sure you're more than familiar with by now, the hermetics question. You can place three figures living or dead into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Yeah, great question, and lots of good possibilities. I think that I would first put Desmond in a room with Hegel and Kierkegaard. First of all, it would just be fun to hear Hegel and Kierkegaard argue. So Hegel, he's a great thinker of system, of mediation, of reconciliation. Kierkegaard, the great thinker of the singular, of the unfathomable, of what can't be folded into any system, and especially Hegel's system, according to Kierkegaard. And there's a way in which I think Desmond wants to sort of draw on what's best in both of them. You know, he's a systematic thinker, but he insists that he's not trying to offer a closed system. He's interested in sort of the dialectical back and forth, the mediation between people, between things, but also he wants to insist that that mediation never exhausts their excess, right? So, you know, like a great work of art, you know, I can spend all this time with it. I learn more about it. It transforms me, but I never sort of exhaust that work of art. So, in a way, he wants to, you know, honor that sort of Kierkegaardian singularity and excess. So it'd be interesting to hear those, that conversation. It'd be interested to hear while Kierkegaard and Hegel were having a debate, who Desmond ended up siding with at times. I think that would be really revealing. It would be interesting to hear what both of those thinkers thought of what Desmond is up to. So those would be interesting. The third thinker I would put in there is the contemporary philosopher Byung-Chul Han, who I think is another one of these just amazing contemporary thinkers. Probably his best known book right now is called The Burnout Society. Mm-hmm. But I think he has a lot of books that are worth reading. So like Desmond, like Hegel, like Kierkegaard, Han's interested in the relationship between philosophy, art, and religion, and they each sort of approach that in a different way. So that conversation would be interesting. I think Desmond would kind of push back at Han a little bit to try to figure out what some of his presuppositions about being are, sort of some of the things he wants to say about a transcendence, like how strong a transcendence we're talking about. I think Desmond, you know, is sort of that more of that metaphysician bent, while Han comes out of more of a Heideggerian background. So there'd be a little tension there, even though they have a lot of shared interest in attention and contemplation. And Han, for his part, just has great analysis of the digital age and technology and some of the sort of emerging malaises of our society. So, and that's something that I think Desmond has a lot to offer, but hasn't written a lot about. So I think that's a really interesting kind of supplement to what Desmond's up to.
That's an interesting room, and you've drawn out the connections there, so I don't need to ask with respect to the thread. In a certain sense, I'll be honest, if I was to meet Kierkegaard, I would probably ask firstly if I could try his famous coffee drink. I don't know if you've heard about this.
No,
well, supposedly the rumor is that every morning he'd fill up his coffee mug completely with sugar, and then he'd go make another mug of extremely strong coffee, and he'd pour that over the sugar, and once that dissolved, he'd then drink this sludge, which then caused him to write. So I'd say to him, can I try that insane dream? Maybe that's why he had an inability, unlike Hegel, to sort of draw things together, because he was so, you know. But it doesn't, you know, it's a strange rumor. Obviously, you know, infamously, I'm not keen on Hegel, so this rumor is very strange to me. So, I mean, really, do you think this rumor actually ties in with, you know, this first question here and one of the foundations of Desmond, which is to do, you've already brought it in, but this idea of an excess of being, you know, do you think that's certain, in a certain way, they are all dealing with some sense of excess of being, but this becomes quite defined for Desmond?
Yeah, I think that's right. And that coffee drink sounds pretty intense. It's maybe how Kierkegaard wrote so much. might need to try that. So Desmond would say that we see beings excessive in a few different ways. So one is just in the sheer number of things out there. So I thought I might read a really short passage from Desmond that I like a lot on this topic. I think it's one of the places where we see sort of Desmond's more poetic side. He says that the world teems with things, throngs with beings, great, small, ugly, sweet, on and beneath the earth, things soaring above, things exuberant or menacing in the unknown seas. The world is given as an excess. So we have this excess in just the sheer number of things out there. But then we also have this excess in that we're always kind of immersed in this sensual wave, this wave of sounds and smells and sensations. And we never sort of, William James calls this the much at once, which I really like that that phrase. And we often aren't aware of that, because we're pretty darn good at being, we've been immersed in it for so long, we're inured to it, we're pretty darn good at bracketing it out. We get caught up in our projects and our thoughts and our concerns. But anytime we start to attend to it, we realize that there's all this stuff going around us that we haven't been attending to. And there's always more that we could attend to in our sort of sensory experience. So there's an excess there as well. There's an excess in others, right? So even people that we know well can surprise us. You know, a friendship, you know, we go back and forth, we get to know each other, we deepen it, we become a kindred spirit. But anytime we think we have the friend figured out completely, we're liable to be surprised, and we're liable to be a pretty bad friend. In my book, I have a chapter on epiphanies in literature, these epiphanic encounters between characters in literature that also, I think, shine some light on these encounters in light. And often there's stories of, you know, like James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues, these two brothers, you know, brothers think they know each other well, but the story turns on this revelation of how much sort of misunderstanding there's been, especially between the narrator and Sonny. Mm-hmm. Or a story like James Joyce's The Dead, where it's between a husband and a wife. So yeah, there's an excess in the other that we can never sort of fully exhaust, and we need to kind of respect. And part of sort of respecting someone is, I think, respecting that fact that we don't have them all figured out. Mm-hmm. There's an excess in ourselves. We surprise ourselves. Even, you know, we should strive for self-knowledge, but we never have our own motivations fully figured out. You know, thoughts, memories spring unbidden in our head. You know, dreams show this excess. And then for Desmond, go ahead.
So just to ask, I mean, so this excess is never a wastage, right? Because many philosophers, I mean, I'm thinking of Georges Bataille, if you've ever read any of his work. I mean, he's one of the philosophers who's dealt with excess. I mean, Visions of Excess is one of his more famous collections. And for him, excess is really, I mean, you know, the atheology of almost all of being is an excess. It's just this pure wastage. So an excess of being almost seems like this more, but for Desmond, this is something which is like, there's always these possibilities of delving further and further into things. So it's a positive excess. You know, sometimes when we speak of excess, especially in relation to theology and with respect to Christianity, you'd think of maybe gluttony or you know, sloth as an excess of rest or some form of this. But this isn't almost like and to draw in your title, it's an excess of wonder, an excess of splendor, which you always have the option to delve into more. So it's, I guess the difficult question is that excess is actually the norm, but we always, as you know, right at the start, you mentioned modernity, we're almost always constraining ourselves with respect to what can be done with what we've been to given, you know, to draw in Duns, actually, my conversation with Duns, and I need to get this right, given is it as granted? Yeah, given as granted and then taken for granted, right? So given as granted, you have it, and then so that the excess is almost given as granted. There's a lot of things to throw at you there. So, but it's not the main thing is it's not, it couldn't be seen as this term wastage or something like that.
Yeah, I think for Desmond, it would be a positive excess. And it's interesting you bring up Bataille because that's another thinker I thought about for the initial conversation. Because there's a way in which I think Bataille and Desmond are kind of like inverted twins in their concerns. Those concerns with excess, the concerns with religion, art, and philosophy. There's a lot of shared interests that they take in very different ways. So that's a very that would be another really interesting conversation. I think one thing that Desmond is also a careful thinker. He wants to sort of capture as much nuance as he can, while also always sort of saying, I haven't got it all figured out. But I think one of the things he would say is that, of course, we have to have some narrowing of our focus and just sort of get things done. So it's not bad that we're bracketing out some of what's going around us. But there's a danger that we always sort of go too far and sort of closing ourselves off. Or there might be situations in where you need to close yourself off, which some sort of like more stoic position is just a means of survival if you're in a really rough situation or abusive situation, harsh situation, if you're a prisoner of war or something like that. But that's not the ideal way to be. The ideal way to be is to be receptive and open to the sort of positive excess, not just for your own fulfillment, but again, sort of to be able to attend and care for those things around us.
So it's to be porous, to draw in the language of Desmond. It's that humans are porous beings in the sense of porosity, and I guess we'd commonly think of porous in relation to sweat pores, which is probably the ones we know, which is letting things out. And I'm sure it could probably drag that metaphor out with respect to those types of pores. But we're porous in the sense that we have this potential for an open relationship with this excess.
So Desmond would say that humans are constitutively receptive or constitutively porous, to use that language. And as you point out, it's a nice sort of gritty metaphor for it. And there's a way in which the literal level is part of it. We do have porous skin. We're receptive through our sense organs. We continually take in food and water in order to survive. But we're also porous in our interiority. A song that we overhear might stir up memories. We have this, we're always sort of responding to things that we've taken in, even in our inwardness, even in our thoughts. So Desmond would say that modern philosophy has had a tendency to emphasize humans as willing creatures, as creatures of the will, sometimes humans just as willed. You sort of see that with Hobbes and Spinoza, the human as a conatus. And Desmond would say that's part of the picture. That's an important part of the picture. We are striving creatures, but we're also receptive creatures. And if we don't attend to that receptivity too, we're first of all not going to be able to accurately understand the human experience in the world because that's so important to it. It's going to distort things. And also, there are all these sort of normative and ethical affordances that come from being more aware of what's going on around you. So it's important in that regard too. So Desmond says that we kind of want to aim for a responsive balance between receptivity and willingness. You might think of a great athlete or a great dancer or a great artist. They don't just sort of exert their will on something. They're always responding to the given situation. They're scanning it for affordances. They're hyper aware. So they have this really supple balancing between receptivity and willing. Or even you might think about something like a nurse and a doctor. If they walk into the room with you and they immediately start surgery, that's too much striving and willing, right? They need to ask some questions. They need to look at you. They need to be receptive. They too, when they're in a very different way than those other exemplars, have to balance this receptivity and striving.
So with regard to, you know, how Desmond, you mentioned at the start how Desmond sort of affected you. I mean, is one of the things with this receptivity that for Desmond, you know, for Desmond, can this receptivity ever be passive? Or are we always making, in some sense, a decision with respect to what it is we're being receptive towards, you know? I'm thinking, you know, somewhat of the mystic Gurdjieff with this respect, who says that, you know, of course we have normal food that we eat and we digest that, but equally the air is something we take in. And to go even further, and I think more importantly, impressions, right? So literally sense data is something we're taking in, being receptive towards, to use the language of Desmond, and in that sense Gurdjieff would say digesting, but we're taking it in, and in some sense it becomes part of us. So in the sense then, in terms of, if you think about it as food, as receptivity, you can see the difference between someone who would be living in the country, you know, and they're the world that they're being receptive to is nature, is beauty, is natural trees and streams and these symbols of life, and someone who's living in some industrial complex is ultimately being receptive to, you know, something completely different. So in that sense, you know, the attention that you brought in and the attentiveness that you brought in at the beginning is really a means to, is that a means to go, whoa, hang on, what am I being receptive towards? What am I letting in? What am I opening my pores to?
Yeah, I think that is part of it for sure. And I think that we're never just sort of flatly receptive. We're always kind of mediating and receiving and sort of responding, even at sort of an unconscious level. But I think Desmond would say that we sort of, he provides us with some of these practices for striking this balance between clearing our porosity and becoming more attentive in sort of the same time. Art, I think, offers a great example of this, right? Attending to the artwork that involves receptivity, but it does also involve sort of our active attention at the same time. And, you know, we're sort of focusing our receptivity onto that artwork while we're spending time with it, while we're allowing it to enter into us, while we're answering its call, might be what Desmond would prefer to say, rather than allowing it. I think too that sometimes this can be just something we practice in our interpersonal relationships, being attentive to those around us. That's always sort of a mix of that receptivity and action. There's always some sort of filtering out to sort of attend to other people. You know, if I'm having this conversation and my phone dings and I pull it out, I'm not attending. So there does need to be some filtering in that regard, even in the service of sort of a deeper receptivity in that conversation. But then Desmond also, you think about, you brought up contemplation in nature. And there, I think the receptivity does sort of pan out more widely, right? You're really trying to sort of open yourself broadly. And he describes what he calls this practice of agapeic mind. And let me see if I can pull this up. So he describes this practice of agapeic mind. And in there, he calls it, you're trying to develop like a non-instrumental vigilance. So sort of this hyper awareness that's not really directed at anything in particular. It's just trying to take it in. And he describes really lyrically his experience of this on a beach in Ireland. And at first, you know, all these other thoughts are sort of popping up, but over time, he says that his mind passes over into the place and the place passes over into the mind. And he starts being aware of all these things that he wasn't aware of before. And there's something to be said for that sort of more expansive sense of receptivity too. But in a way, it always has to be situational, right? We can't go around all the time in sort of that kind of state. We still have to go to work and attend to the needs of others and sort of be sort of narrow the focus. But when the focus gets narrowed too much and we become just sort of striving or willing and we cut off that receptivity, that's when we're more likely to run roughshod over other people. It's when we're more likely to sort of get trapped in our own sort of thoughts and spiral. So there's always a danger in becoming sort of too closed off. Though you're probably right, there's also probably a danger in many situations of being sort of too open as well.
So it's almost like the, you know, the cross, right? Too much of the horizontal or too much in the vertical. It needs to be some balance between it. You still got to have your feet on the ground. So do you think in that way that really the, you know, I'm sort of dragging out the idea of the pause here, but the sense in which we don't become overwhelmed by this excess of being, which is obviously, you know, the splendor and the sublime nature of the world, is because ultimately our pores get clogged. It's like it's too much. It's like it's like porous indigestion.
Yeah, and he actually uses that language sometimes. He's like, you know, the porosity becomes clogged. And again, I just love sort of the grittiness and kind of the grossness of that on one level. I think it kind of matches in a way sort of the feeling of self-enclosure that can develop from that, of being sort of just stewing in your own juices, not having sort of anything sort of coming into you. Well, I think that Desmond he's more concerned with being closed off than he is sort of being overwhelmed by the excess. And one of the things he would say is that no matter how sort of closed off we are, we can never sort of totally clog our pores in all senses of it, right? We'd overheat on the literal level, but also at these sort of more metaphorical levels as well. So even if you're a really hardened, skeptical, no-nonsense, closed-off modern, you can always be sort of blown open again by wonder. You can't sort of totally close yourself off to that. And, you know, oftentimes we go around with very legitimate worries and concerns. And in that regard, something like beauty or the sublime that you brought up can be kind of a gift. It kind of strikes us. It's an experience of wonder in that way. It calls us out of ourselves. It draws us out of ourselves. And there's a release in that. Certainly with the sublime, can be a more exhilarating, even frightening, extreme experience. But Desmond would say that beauty too calls, beauty too moves. It's not just a passive thing. And in that regard, he challenges kind of the modern aesthetics that juxtaposes a soothing beauty mm-hmm. with a stirring sublime. Mm-hmm. You should get that in someone like Edmund Burke, and it becomes very sort of important for the rest of aesthetics in its wake. But Desmond say that beauty too can stir, beauty too strikes us and calls us out of ourselves. So he prefers to see the relationship between the beautiful and the sublime as what he calls a permeable threshold between the two.
So what role does God play? So far, we haven't even mentioned the word. So where is prayer and where is God here?
Yeah. So maybe I'll approach that. There's a lot that could be said about that. That's that's a massive part of what Desmond is up to, especially in his throughout all his works, but especially in his 2008 book God in the Between. But maybe I'll approach it via prayer, because I think it dovetails nicely with what we've been talking about with porosity. Mm-hmm. So silence and prayer are these sort of classic philosophical and spiritual practices for building awareness, for clearing porosity, to use Desmond's language. They kind of still are chattering and get us to attend. And of course, there are many sorts of prayer, but Desmond is particularly interested in a sort of prayer where we try to deepen that inner porosity to the point that we kind of touch the inside us the ontological wellspring where we're sort of being given our being. It's a very Augustinian thought. Mm-hmm. And Desmond wouldn't hesitate to call that source God, and to say mm-hmm. that in that experience of prayer, there is a personal dimension. There is a communication that can take place in that intense porosity, where we realize that in our deepest beings, we are porous to the divine. Mm. So I think he would agree with Kierkegaard too, that one of the most important sorts of prayer is one where we shut up. It's not about what we say. It's about listening and stilling ourselves until we can hear the voice of God.
I don't want to cheapen the metaphor, but in this sense, is entering into that form of silence where you're opening something up or allowing something in, or is that the equivalent of really entering into an ontological sauna and sweating out the pores?
I think Desmond would love that. I'll probably send this to him and I'll ask him what he thinks of that. I think he'd really like that comparison. You know, because he I don't think it cheapens it, right? I mean, I think that he's always interested in sort of keeping a little humor with things too. But there's also sort of a truth in that, right? We got to sweat through our own preoccupations in a way. And if you read sort of spiritual masters on prayer, there is sort of a struggle in prayer often, in that regard.
But one thing, I mean, just because recently I've been reading his work, but just to draw in Meister Eckhart with the notion of a negative theology, not to get too complicated here, but one of Eckhart's major gripes with the way people approached prayer was that in relation to negative theology of this, we need to remove things, that prayer became transactional. So it's like instead of just entering into what we're talking about with respect to, I will just be in the presence of God, and in that sense, I am just thanking or praising or loving God. It's transactional, and they're like, you're right, you get down, you're like, God, I really need this right now, right? And in that sense, is that sort of Eckhartian view of just don't let allow it to be transactional, because actually you're sort of clogging up your pores even more, because you're piling more on. And what you really need to be is just enter into that wonder.
Yeah, I think Desmond would say that that is really important. And there is this danger that the way Desmond might put it is, too much striving, too much of your willing, and not enough receptivity. But I also think that Desmond would say that, something like praying for someone else. I think that that can be very pat and very cliche. Don't worry about the situation. I'm just going to pray for you. And that's not very spiritually serious. But if you really pray for someone else, it is going to you're going to recognize the excess and mystery of their situation. You're going to sort of reawaken, perhaps, especially if it's someone that you're struggling with, maybe like a coworker that you're not getting along with. You're going to probably realize the role that you're playing in making this problem. And you're sort of opening yourself to sort of new perspectives and possibilities on it. I have a little section in the book on this where I use a great theologian, Howard Thurman, whose influence on Martin Luther King Jr., just really important theologian, and he talks about prayer for others in this way, and I think that's a way that Desmond would resonate with as well. So yeah, I think that Desmond would say that we're always in danger, especially in sort of the religion of today, of losing that sort of deeper sense of silent prayer, and that's really important. Though I also say, I think you see this whole spate of books on silence, on contemplation. I think people realize that we're sort of needing that, but that's because we sort of lost it. And I think he would say that that's a really important practice.
Well, I think the problem with silence, and this is sort of a quip that I've been throwing around lately to a lot of from a lot of people. I mean, if we take the idea of these books like Millionaire Fastlane, right, sold 40 million copies, or Finding Peace in the World sold 40 million copies, my question always is, well, where are all the millionaires? Where are all these peaceful people? And I think one of the problems is with respect to the silence that we're talking about is once again that confusion of perhaps confusing the silence with the external world. Like, just because you're within a sensual silence doesn't mean you're within an ontological silence. So to draw in another thinker, but Michel Serres sort of says that the human mind has become economizing. So you wouldn't think that if you're in the depths of the rainforest that you would be in any sense within some form of sort of mechanical or modern economy, but you've actually brought something with you which is almost inescapable, where you're thinking like, well, actually, I could cut down those trees and I could draw a straight line, right? So
Sure.
you haven't you ha you've brought the noise with you. And so that noise, that in the relation to the silence, is really to do with being. It's to do with how you're composing yourself. In the depths of your being. So just because you're within a silence, I guess with your prayers, the noise, the common noise of prayer might be, oh, I just need to get, 5 more minutes and I'll be there, right? That itself is a noise. And in that way, I guess back to Eckhart, he sort of says it's to do with the intent. The silence is the intent. So whether it's an hour or if it's 5 minutes, it's to do with that relationship of quality. But I'm throwing a lot at you with that.
No, I think that's spot on. And one thing you might say, and I don't mean this at all in a self-righteous way, because I certainly struggle with it, is that the practice is a lot harder than reading the book, even though reading a book is a great first start. And that's probably why there aren't the millions of readers of these books haven't sort of transformed our ethos of being yet through their attention and their capacity for silence and contemplation. And I think that's right. And I think that's one of the things that sort of Ryan Duns and I share about our interest in Desmond, is sort of drawing out some of these practices he offers. So reading him is a practice, as Duns says, but there are also these practices like agapeic mind, like attending to art, like trying to clear the inner porosity that he offers us. But then you got to do them, and you got to keep doing them. And that's a hard thing.
Oh, that's the hardest thing to do, is to actually do things. It's much easier to read a book about your problem. You just keep getting more and more specific books. Same with the Bible. It's easier to read a commentary on Genesis than read Genesis.
True.
But just to draw in this practice, I mean, I think it was Schopenhauer, right? So Schopenhauer said, any philosopher who, just to paraphrase, I believe it was him, I may be wrong, but he said, any philosopher who doesn't deal with music is, you know, shouldn't be taken seriously. And I would change that now to add, leave music in, but also to say any philosopher that doesn't deal with laughter shouldn't be taken seriously. And I'm always extremely happy to see philosophers deal with laughter, because it's this great anomaly of existence. You know, Freud would say that it's concealing something. Others consider it to be like just this completely absurd gesture. And, you know, for Desmond as well, it plays a very, you know, it's quite the irony, right? Laughter plays a serious role. And what, you know, talking of practice, what is the role of laughter here?
Yeah. So probably the chapter on laughter in my book is, I think, my favorite in the study. And I love Desmond's own writings on laughter, and he's been writing about it throughout his whole career. And he's a really funny guy. He has his own sort of jokes and asides in the book. I don't know whether I'll be able to execute it well, but one of my favorite parts in his chapter on laughter in this, in one of his more recent books, is he's talking about Camus' Myth of Sisyphus and this very serious, like the same struggle, pushing the rock up every day and having rolling it back. And we have to imagine him happy. And Desmond's like, well, what if we just think about Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner? He's always running off the cliff. He's falling. He's coming back up. He's stuck in the same loop. But you laugh about it, and it sort of transforms the whole thing. And, you know, it's kind of flippant. It's a little mordant, but there's also sort of this deep truth in it, that one of the things that interests Desmond is there are many, many sorts of laughs. You know, some philosophers are looking for sort of a skeleton key that'll explain all kinds of laughter, you know, boil it down to one phenomenon or one underlying cause. Desmond would say that's not going to work. You're going to need a whole key ring if you want to sort of try to understand laughter. And there are definitely philosophers that have a better sense of this, you know, hat tip to Nietzsche. I think that he really gets a sense of sort of the range of laughter, and Kierkegaard too. But one kind of laughter that really interests Desmond is a laughter of kind of release and renewal. So you're in a crappy situation. You're in a tough situation. I think about, you know, recently I was working on a plumbing project in the house, and it was really giving me troubles. And I end up sort of busting my knuckles against the pipe. And of course, you know, what I want to do is swear and throw the wrench. But, you know, if you could just laugh in that moment, you're going to sort of reset in a way that's going to make you better prepared to deal with the situation and keep a broader perspective, instead of just sort of building up that sort of frustration and tightening. So, you know, that might in some ways resonate with one of the sort of accounts of laughter that sees it more sort of like a safety valve or a release valve for sort of pressure. But I think Desmond would want to say that there's this renewing laughter, this redemptive laughter, that's far more human than that, that isn't mechanical in that sort of way. And again, it sort of involves sort of opening up your porosity. But I talk about Moby Dick in the chapter on laughter. And Moby Dick is this great novel with many sorts of laughs. It catalogs so many things in Moby Dick, but one of the things it catalogs is laughs. So any philosopher that wants to think about laughter is going to find plenty of material and plenty to challenge them in Melville's great novel. And there are these redemptive and laughters of release throughout Moby Dick too, where they sort of bring some healing in a hard situation. But that's the kind of laugh that Ahab just can't laugh. He can't laugh this sort of redemptive laughter of release, or he can't shed the redemptive tear of release. And of course, laughter and crying are so closely related. If he could, that would allow him to sort of expand beyond his monomania, expand beyond sort of this vengeance quest with the whale, and sort of see the world anew and sort of in a broader way. So there's this kind of laughter that sort of returns you to zero, which is one of these phrases that Desmond likes to use, and sort of offers sort of a fresh start. You know, that's easier said than done, and it can sound very flippant, But in those situations, we kind of need all the various possibilities that we can to try to find some makeshift healing and release. And I think Desmond would say that often we vastly underestimate the important role that laughter plays in just sort of getting us through the day-to-day grind, let alone the harsher realities of life, the harsher tragedies.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange thing, because in a certain sense, when you're utilizing laughter as a release, you're taking yourself very seriously, because you're building up your problems, you're allowing everything to clog up, you're taking everything that's been brought into you so seriously, and eventually you either have to give way or... It has to, I guess, in a certain sense, you would say that if you clog up your pores so much with your own seriousness and your own striation of what's being impressed upon you, ultimately, it's almost like those videos of the compressors, right? The thing which is being compressed, whatever that is, it has to go somewhere, right? And it has to, there has to be a catharsis, whether it's positive or negative or a breakdown or something in some sense. And laughter, as you say, is that common release valve, which borders on, you know, it's the comedy tragedy thing, right? It's sometimes there's forms of laughter which is like, in the moment of laughter, which way is it going to go? Are you gonna start crying? Are you gonna start crying with joy? Are you gonna, you know, break down at the absurdity of the situation? Or are you gonna, I don't know, perhaps there's a third option. But just on what you said about Sisyphus as well, I mean, I've always found Camus' treatment of Sisyphus to itself to be absurd. Not the absurdism, but the actual treatment of itself from Camus to be basically idiotic. It's probably my least favorite philosophical thing ever. I mean, imagine Sisyphus. All right, so we're just imagining this. So you're saying his plight is real, but you're just imagining it otherwise. I mean, it's a very cruel thing to do to the man. But there's a point I heard about. I don't know too well the classics at all outside of that. And I read recently, maybe you might know better than me, but there is a point in the stories of the classics where Sisyphus actually does stop. He stops to sit on his boulder to look at another tale that's going on. And for me, I just think, why didn't he just stop? I know that sounds ridiculous. It sounds absurd in itself, but if we're going to give in to this absurdism of Camus, why didn't Camus just say, just stop, Sisyphus? Like, just what? You've already been cursed. How can this get worse? I don't know. Maybe I don't know this story well enough, but there you go.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I'd like to look into that, because that just, you know, that that stopping and looking at another just is, that's such a powerful image, right? And there's so rich with, you know, thinking through that. But, you know, maybe that's part of what Desmond is up to with kind of his wry crack about Sisyphus and Wile E. Coyote, right? You know, maybe part of why we laugh at Wile E. Coyote is because he could just stop, right? Why don't you just stop?
But that's his meaning. I think there's almost a respect for Wile E. Coyote. I always had a respect for him. Because a respect, an absurd respect, right? Because every episode there was the in-joke that it was like Acme Company, which you knew was going to blow him up. And it was like the same stupid thing that he'd paint, same sort of simulacrum that he was creating. And it was almost like there's an episode of, you know, just drawing in ridiculous things now, but to speak of other cartoons of the era, there's an episode of... Tweety Bird and Sylvester, I can't remember what it's called. You know, he's constantly trying to catch the bird. And one episode he does. he believes he does. He believes he's killed Tom and Jerry. There's an episode of Tom and Jerry where he believes he's finally caught Jerry, the mouse, and actually killed Jerry. And he ends up being depressed and paranoid and feeling awful. And all of the meaning is void in his life. So there's this sort of absurdness in just trying to shoehorn this metaphor out in some sense, but that laughter is almost the absurdity of the inability to ever, I guess, fully be in that thing that you're after. And if you were, it's just not going to work, right? That's to draw in Vogelin, that would be the moment where you immortalize the eschaton and you're almost in a complete moment of disappointment, right? Like, oh yeah, it's like a dog's caught his tail, right? So I don't know what to do now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really interesting. It gets into all the complexities with these things. You know, if you take it back to Ahab, there's a grandeur in Ahab for the same reason, in that he, the quest, as diabolical as it might be, as destructive as it might be, there's a grandeur to it. There's a grandeur to him wanting to sort of insist on the meaningfulness of what happened to him, and for him to try to to strike back against not just the whale, but the universe. Mm. And there is a way in which that if he had that laughter of release or the tears of release, he would, it would be kind of an existential crisis for him at the same time, right? He'd have to find a new meaning. Mm. But also, of course, I think that's bound up with, especially with Ahab, with the sense that there can be sort of issues of pride involved there too. Mm. And a laughter, there's a laughter that can be kind of self-deflating of pride, a laughter of humility, a laughter that returns us, Desmond would say, to the community of human beings, rather than sort of think that we're sort of up above them, as Ahab explicitly says, you know, with neither gods nor men for company on his heights.
I mean, he's nothing without the whale. We all need our little whale. Maybe that's something to be done. It's just to have joy in the whale. I don't know. I don't know where to go with that metaphor. But
well, that's the interesting thing, right? Can you imagine an Ahab that sort of takes all of his philosophical seriousness, but yet also sort of is able to release out of this monomaniacal quest? That's an interesting thing to think about. Would he be a saint then? I don't know.
Yeah, I think
we see hints of that in his relationship with Pip, I think.
I think you'd have to be a saint, otherwise you wouldn't believe it, right? It's almost like if Ahab didn't catch the whale and could have, and then just said, actually, I'm fine, you know, and had some catharsis, you'd go, I really don't believe you, right? You'd have to become a saint. That's interesting. Well, moving just into the title, and really, I guess we've sort of tiptoed around the issue a lot. I mean, why is it called Wonder Strikes? You know, what is this role? What role does Wonder play here?
Yeah, so the Wonder Strikes, the title part of that, what that does is sort of brings into play maybe three big themes that we've already talked about. You get that theme of receptivity. Wonder strikes us. Mm-hmm. Wonder isn't just on demand. We can never make ourselves experience wonder. We can certainly cultivate receptivity, and therefore we're going to experience more wonder, but we can never just sort of make it happen. Mm. It always sort of happens to us. So you get that theme of receptivity. You also get that theme of excess, I think, with, you know, the wonder of reality sort of striking us. And then wonder itself is a key term for Desmond. And as I said, that's the one that really drew me into his work. Desmond actually differentiates three modalities of wonder. Mm-hmm. The first and primary one for him is astonishment, astonished wonder. And in that, you're really sort of blown apart in a positive way with that excess of being. So this maybe goes back to your initial questions too about whether that excess can ever be threatening or just waste. In the experience of astonishment, it's a positive good thing. So experience of astonishment will give rise to gratitude, to care. It's this sort of beneficent experience of wonder. Mm-hmm. And it also is the experience of wonder, Desmond says, that is most shot through with the mystery of being, often implicitly. It's not necessarily think it, but it's shot through with this strangeness that anything exists at all, with this strangeness that this exists or this person exists. And Desmond says that all things in a way are haloed with the mystery of their existence, the mystery that they exist rather than not existing. Mm. But in wonder, we're really sort of stirred by that. And on the flip side, we're also stirred by the wonder of our own existence. There's kind of a double wonder at play there in astonishment. Mm. Second modality of wonder is perplexity. So in perplexity, the mystery of being becomes something a little bit more unsettling and sort of rattles us. Sometimes it can rattle us in very extreme ways, because we might also be perplexed by things like evil or death or suffering. And they raise these, again, kind of profound metaphysical questions. But here it's in a more unsettled and harsh way. You know, instead of the excess, often what you're tending to is sort of the ambiguity and the indeterminacy and experiences of perplexity. Again, to go back to Ahab, you know, in the famous quarterdeck chapter, he says, I've got to smash through the pasteboard mask of reality and figure out what's behind there. That's what I've got to do. But of course, he can't do that, right? So that just deepens the perplexity. And perplexity isn't certainly at all always sort of pathological like that. It's a key to religion, art, and philosophy too. both astonishment and perplexity are these sort of fundamental spurs to thought and to creation and to religion. Third modality is curiosity. And there, what we're interested in is how things work. So it doesn't any longer have this sort of deeper mystery at play, like the mystery of being or the mystery of evil. Now we're interested in how, you know, say, we can build a better tool, or, you know, how a bird builds its nest, or how we can solve this mechanical problem. And curiosity is obviously central to science, and curiosity, all modes of wonder have their valid, crucial role to play. And curiosity can remain rooted in a deeper astonishment. And I think that's often the case of great scientists. But curiosity can also be shorn of that deeper wonder. And then there's the danger that it's just going to become instrumentalizing. And it's just going to become kind of more utilitarian. And it's going to sort of just see everything around us as sort of problems and resources to manipulate. And, you know, the possibility for pride sort of enters in much strongly with this curiosity that's shorn of a deeper wonder. And Desmond thinks that one tendency in modernity is to have this kind of shorn curiosity, some of this bare curiosity. And that becomes our main way of interacting with the world, our main way of understanding
that. What does he mean by a bare curiosity?
So a curiosity that's not sort of maintaining this deeper wonder at the strangeness of being, at the excess of being, at the ways that being evades us, but it's all about sort of how we can figure out how things work.
Existence taken for granted, not as granted.
Yep.
So there does seem to be in all of those three forms of wonder, there does seem to be a deep position for grace.
Yeah.
The fact that something is just given. And it's in the fact that something is given that you find your wonder. Because as soon as something is, I guess when you're speaking of the blow of development of evolution, and not specifically Darwinian, but of that form of process where something is clearly developed in some linear progressive form, wonder is removed because you go, oh, I trace it back. Look, that's, you know, we were all amoebas or something at some point, as if that nullifies the wonder. But when something is just given in that sense, when there is a grace, when there is a, I guess in a certain sense of revelation, so it's somewhat theological but not strictly speaking, that's where the wonder comes in. But if you don't have that, then, you know, all of the world, all of the sense, everything is, well, of course that would be that way, and I just live in it, it's completely quantified, there's no quality to existence.
I think that's right. And, you know, the deeper astonished wonder, it's not a matter of, at the deepest level, it's not wondering at how one thing turns into another. It's a wonder that anything is at all, including the laws of science, right? It sort of gets at that deeper level of what Desmond calls the coming to be rather than becoming. Though there's also, you know, you can have astonishment at things that are very much a part of reality and becoming, you know, like beauty, you know, intricacies and orders that, you know, emerge. Yeah, so Desmond is hardly anti-science, you know, and I think he would readily agree that both that, you know, technology has done much good, that science has a lot of, that it's, you know, it's a crucial part of sort of the human endeavor. Mm-hmm. But, and great scientists often do sort of not sort of give way to this crude instrumentalizing, but there is that danger in science, and especially maybe applied technology has often sort of taken that road in modernity.
Do you think we can ever broach that impasse between those who are, if we were to understand those who take reality or life as a given and don't have that deeper curiosity, if we could say that that's disenchantment, and then the other form is being enchanted to the sense that you're just imbued with wonder, like, wow, you know, what is this? Do you think that impasse can ever be broached? Do you think there can ever be a leap from... Do you think the disenchanted can happen, I should say, because it can definitely happen, because I've known myself included, but how can the disenchanted become enchanted?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think this is one of the reasons why Desmond thinks that metaphysics remain important, because I think Desmond would say that we always have metaphysical assumptions. We can't escape those. We have assumptions about what being is and what its value is. We have those as cultures. We have those as individuals, even post-metaphysical philosophers have those kind of assumptions. Mm-hmm. And right now we have a lot of sort of bad assumptions about being out there. And we need to sort of counter those. You know, we need to sort of answer to bad metaphysics for Desmond isn't no metaphysics. It's always better metaphysics. And I don't think that he thinks that his own metaphysics are going to sort of come in and save the day, but they might contribute to this sort of reawakening. I think that one of the places that we see it is that in our culture, I think we get this idea that the objective reality of things is kind of their use value and what they can be made to do. And we certainly pay plenty of attention to things like beauty and aesthetics and, you know, even spiritual experience, but we tend to see that as just subjective. It isn't sort of a revelation of the excess of being. It's just sort of a personal subjective experience. That's something to do with your head, your tastes, your feelings. And therefore, that means that when it comes to sort of making decisions about sort of policy or economics, that utilitarian logic often comes to the fore. And I think we also kind of find ourselves in a bind sometimes because we still, you know, very much want to sort of protect the inherent worth of things and people, but we don't really have very good metaphysical resources or philosophical resources for doing that. And I think it's slowly becoming undermined. So, you know, I'm sort of rambling around a bit, but I think one thing would be, you know, the experience of wonder, sort of seeing that as not just subjective, even though it clearly has, you know, a subjective component and, you know, we're involved in it, but also as a disclosure of the excess of being, seeing being as sort of having an inherent worth due to its singularity and excess. That's sort of a key to re-enchanting. And Desmond would say, too, that this is a role that religion, art, and philosophy all have a place to play. So according to Desmond, all three of them kind of have their origins, their taproot in astonished wonder and perplexity. They all sort of grow up out of that. And they all sort of have a vocation to continually kind of take that wonder and excess, that experience of wonder that they grow out of and sort of share it with others, right? To sort of offer a richer ethos of being. In their own ways, they can do that. But they can also easily sort of betray that promise. They can cut themselves off at the taproot. And right now, I think Desmond would say that that sort of happened to all three. And Desmond would say, you know, they might have their legitimate quarrels with each other, but they kind of, in their fullest health, they need each other, right? If one of the three is withering, the other two tend to wither as well, because it means that something has happened with that connection to a deeper astonishment, a deeper sense of the excess of being. And I think he would say that that's sort of happening in all three right now. You know, certainly he's very critical of the ways that religion has, you know, been manipulative or betrayed its highest ends. But he also thinks that you can tell a way too crude and simplistic story that doesn't talk about all the ways that religion has given us our sense of the worth of world, the world and our ethical practices and our practices of self-sacrifice for higher worthy goods. And so I think he would say that if we have any hope, one of the hopes is going to be all of the great religious traditions rediscovering the best in their traditions to sort of address the crises of today and bringing that forward. And, you know, art and philosophy really sort of rediscovering its fullest vocation as well in light of originary wonder. So it's probably going to take many sort of different, and, you know, it might not happen, right? We might just sort of descend deeper into crisis and we only sort of reemerge once we reach the zero point as culture as a whole, who knows, ecological crisis or whatever.
What do you think the individual can do to, approach this strangeness of being, you know, to be able to begin this process of re-enchantment in this sense?
Yeah, I think that it goes back to where we started the conversation. I think cultivating that combination of receptivity and awareness in different important domains in our relationships with other people, in our relationship with the natural world, certainly for religious people in their prayer, the practices of prayer. And I think that alongside that, you know, maybe questioning some of the metaphysical assumptions we've inherited from the wider culture that treats those things as just subjective, right? And sort of trying to regain a richer sense of reality. And I think that, you know, that will change your being in the world and will have an effect on others. And, you know, in a small way, maybe is the most that most of us can do.
Well, we've covered a lot of, the topics and the themes of your book. I mean, is there anything you'd like to add that you feel is key to add in about your book?
No, I don't think so. I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate the great questions.
So whereabouts, so this is Wonder Strikes, Approaching Aesthetics and Literature with William Desmond by, is it SUNY Press or is it Sunny Press?
Yeah, it's State University of New York Press.
Okay, SUNY Press. And I'm assuming we can find that via their website and via Amazon. I'll be sure to put the links in the description below. But yeah, is there anything you'd like to add? I mean, what are you working on now? Are you going to work more on William Desmond?
A little bit. So I'm editing a collection of essays on William Desmond and the Bible right now, with a great lineup of scholars. You know, the scholarship on William Desmond, I already mentioned Dunn's book, is just really rich, and I've benefited from very much in my own work. And it's fun to work with some of those people more directly in this collection. Also, I'm working on co-writing a book about Byung-Chul Han. And that'll be a little while, but I really think that he's another contemporary thinker that is well worth reading. And I bet a lot of your listeners would appreciate his work.
Wow. I'd love to talk about both those books. Sound fascinating. But yeah, Stephen Nepper, thanks very much.
Thank you.